Hello and welcome back to Ready Player None, the only podcast where a white man can have his say on popular culture. In the wake of Wade's meeting with Nolan Sorrento, head of IOI, the Sixers have closed in on the location of the Copper Key. The world's top five Gunters got together in an emergency chat room meeting, where our protagonists proved so unlikable that two of them immediately left the group. The two Gunters, Daito and Shoto, were written as every Japanese samurai stereotype that Ernest Cline could think of. An inauspicious introduction to the book's first characters who are people of colour. We were left with the possibility that the meeting was observed by a Sixer spy, which I think is Artemis. Let's take a look at what Chapter 16 has to offer us. So the scoreboard begins filling up, telling us that after the High Five, the Sixers have started to clear the first gate. Were they named the High Five purely so that the sixth person in position could be a Sixer? Wade recognises the employee number of the first Sixer to clear the first gate. It's the number that matches Nolan Sorrento's avatar. But for our third consecutive chapter, we're told about these hacked immersion rigs, and that there was no way Nolan Sorrento was that good at Joust or knew all of war games by heart. There's no way a nerd could possibly be evil. Just name a real-life megacorporation run by a nerd. Over the next 24 hours, over 60 Sixer avatars cleared the first gate. For a change of pace, this next part has got in-universe creative bankruptcy. So with Ludus being overrun by Gunters and Sixers alike, the public school board sees fit to copy and paste the planet, creating Ludus 2, or maybe Ludus the Second. It's Ludus followed by a Roman numeral 2. So that, to me, says that it's second. But if Klein's going for the science fiction trope of having numbered planets, then it's probably Ludus 2. I never understood that trope. Your spacefaring main characters set down on a planet which the natives call Ligma 4, because they're the fourth planet out from the star Ligma, because somehow they had an accurate model of their own solar system before they invented naming things? I'm getting distracted. The school board duplicates Ludus into Ludus 2 the Second. Electric Boogaloo Ludus. And all the students are given a day off, while a backup copy of the planet's original source code was copied over to the new site, minus the Tomb of Horrors code Halliday had secretly added to it at some point. Classes resumed on Ludus 2 the following day, and Ludus was left for the Sixers and Gunters to fight over. Now the Sixers have not exactly been discreet about what they're up to and where they are, so the word spreads fast to all the Gunter message boards about this quarantine force field they've got around this flat-topped hill with a particular skull pattern on it. So not only do the Gunters immediately draw the conclusion to the D&D module The Tomb of Horrors, but they also know exactly where to go once it all hits the news feeds. This book goes into all sorts of details as to why the bombs don't work and magic spells are being casted and so on, which I'm just going to not bother summarising for you. But I would like to pick up on something that I didn't make clear in the last episode that is clarified here. What did it actually say? The Gunters can attack the force field with RPGs, fireballs, cluster bombs, nukes, turning the forest into a wasteland. So I guess the PvP rules don't apply to the force fields? Are they going to stop working the instant the force field breaks? Thanks, pre-recorded Gherkin. What I meant to ask was, does that mean that all the weapons are going to instantly stop working once the force field's down? Because instead of attacking the force fields, the Gunters will now be attacking the people inside. But it's clarified here that for all the bombs and explosions they can set off, all of the Gunters are unharmed by their own blasts. So it's not that the bombs are going to stop working once the force field goes down, it's just not going to harm any of the people. But it is going to devastate the landscape around it. I'll just pick on a... that's a Freudian slip. I was going to say that I would pick up on these two sentences, but I will pick on them as well. Ernest Cline suddenly thinks he's some Douglas Adams-level funny narrator. The clans began to bombard the outer force field with rockets, missiles, nukes, and harsh language. That would very nearly have been lightly amusing had this book not killed off all my goodwill for it. And this other part here. They pooled their resources and purchased two very expensive, very powerful antimatter bombs on eBay. This is just... obnoxious. This is irritating. I don't know what you're going for tonally. But these are enough to break down both force fields, and thousands of Gunters and Sixers all swarm into the tomb. Every avatar that can fit on the dais fights the Lich King, and 95% of the Gunters who challenged him lost and were then killed. But a few Gunters were successful, and at the bottom of the scoreboard, listed after the High Five and the dozens of IOI employee numbers, new avatar names began to appear, Within a few days, the list of avatars on the scoreboard was over 100 names long. With the sheer amount of Gunters in the area, the Sixers are unable to put the force fields back up. But given there's no PvP combat, both parties are completely unable to stop each other from getting the key. Outside the Oasis, reality catches up to Wade. News reports about the explosions in the stacks show that there are no identifiable remains in the wreckage. And the Sixers seem to have planted drug lab equipment at the scene. It worked like a charm. The cops didn't bother to investigate any further, and consequently the wreckage is just left behind to slowly rust into the earth. I mean, I'd hope they'd get the bodies out first, but if not, that's pretty grim. With his first endorsement payment, Wade makes the move to Columbus, Ohio. What should be a touching scene about leaving behind the only home he's ever known is stymied initially by one of this book's staccato lists of things. You've probably picked up on it in the excerpts that I've read out because they're the most egregious examples of it. But every time this book has to list something out, it just lists it out. It may as well be a bullet-pointed list. So Wade takes with him in an old rucksack, my school-issued Oasis console, visor, and gloves, my dog-eared printout of Anorak's Almanac, my Grail diary, some clothes, my laptop, everything else I left behind. I kept to busy streets and managed to avoid getting mugged on the way to the bus terminal. We know what kind of people are on the dark streets of the stacks, don't we, boys and girls? So there's a customer service kiosk that scans his retinas and prints out his prepaid ticket. That says to me that there's nobody working in the terminal. But then we find out that the bus has a driver. So maybe Wade just went the self-service route, I don't know. The bigger question is, why haven't you invented self-driving cars yet? It was a double-decker, with armor plating, bulletproof windows, and solar panels on the roof. A rolling fortress. I was thinking about this the other day, actually. In the comments below, because I'm not going to look it up, let me know if Americans have double-decker buses. I don't remember ever hearing of one. So the bus driver is encased in a bulletproof plexiglass box. A team of six heavily armed guards rode on the bus's upper deck to protect the vehicle and its passengers in the event of a hijacking by road agents or scavengers. A distinct possibility once we ventured out into the lawless badlands that now existed outside of the safety of large cities. So there's a big Mad Max wasteland situation happening outside and we're just caring about what happens on the internet? You're telling us the wrong story! Show me the scavengers! I want them! So it's an electric bus, so it's got a top speed of 40 miles per hour. It consequently takes several days to get to Columbus. We're told the most important thing, that you can jack into the Oasis on the bus. But where do they eat, or sleep, or go to the bathroom? All of this is just glossed over. Unsurprisingly, Wade spends his time on the bus in the Oasis. He sets up a new identity using his famous Gunter reputation to convince people of the Oasis underworld to hack into government organisations for him. He gains access to a highly exclusive illegal data auction site known as the Leet Hacksaw's Warehouse. I'm not going to spell out all of that, but imagine the most Leet-speak spelling that you can think of for those three words, and you've pretty much got it. When did this book come out again? 2011? This was dated even then. Ernest Cline truly is a man who can't keep up with the times. And for a shockingly small amount of money, I was able to purchase a series of access procedures and passwords for the USCR, United States Citizen Registry, database. So he replaces his own fingerprints and retinal pattern in the database with that of his deceased father, who as we know was a cool guy despite how he died, and he copies them to a new identity he made up, that of Bryce Lynch. I made Bryce 22 years old and gave him a brand new social security number, an immaculate credit rating, and a bachelor's degree in computer science. I looked it up and Bryce Lynch is a computer hacker child prodigy with dubious morals from Max Headroom. This is a book that just waves its inspirations right in front of your face, doesn't it? Now that his identity's set up, he looks for an apartment in Columbus. This bit's actually kind of interesting because we learn that due to the Oasis, people don't travel for business or pleasure anymore. And so this hotel has been converted into a series of apartments. I just feel like that's a good use of infrastructure. Maybe I'm the nerd. Each unit had been modified to meet the very specific needs of a full-time Gunter. Alright. Most importantly, it offered a direct fiber optic connection to the main Oasis server vault, which was located just a few miles away. This was the fastest and most secure type of internet connection available, and since it wasn't provided by IOI or one of its subsidiaries, I wouldn't have to be paranoid about them monitoring my connection or trying to trace my location. I would be safe. Two chapters ago, we found out that Wade had a dream of moving to Columbus, and he's just done it. On a bus ride. Even the difficult things are easy. This is a Teflon protagonist. It also says here that Wade pays 6 months' rent up front, so that his agent doesn't ask him any awkward questions. All right. Hold on, I've got to go and put the washing out. And we're back. This show's just thrown together. So on Wade's long journey, he sometimes takes off his Oasis visor in the late hours of the night just to see what other parts of the country would look like. But the view was perpetually bleak, and each decaying, overcrowded city we rolled through looked just like the last. And then this part's borderline interesting. The Columbus skyline appeared on the horizon, glittering like Oz at the end of the yellow brick road. We arrived around sunset, and already there were more electric lights burning in the city than I'd ever seen at one time. Of course, like anything in this book, the fantastical depiction of the city as a technological utopia lasts for only one paragraph. Wade gets off the bus, and the reality of his situation starts to set in. Powerful people were out looking for me, people who wanted me dead. He hails an auto cab. So there are self-driving vehicles then, it's just that this bus isn't one of them. Okay. He's still lightheaded and anxious as the cab takes him to his destination, which turns out to be an old Hilton hotel on the edge of the Twin Rivers ghetto. I nearly just said something stupid like, why does the most powerful city in the world still have a ghetto? But then I remembered that I live in real life. Wade gets by the security checkpoint on the inside of the hotel, thanks to his new established identity, and he goes up the lift to the 42nd floor, room 4211. There was no furniture in the cube-shaped room, and only one window. I stepped inside, closed the door, and locked it behind me. Then I made a silent vow not to go outside again until I had completed my quest. I would abandon the real world altogether until I found the egg. End chapter 16. Now, on the immediately opposite page, we've got our first look at level 2. If you remember, 150-odd pages ago, we had level 1, along with a quote from the Anorak's Almanac. Now, technically, I don't want to touch on level 2 until we get to the next chapter, but I would just like to point out that there's a Groucho Marx quote on this page. I'm not crazy about reality, but it's still the only place to get a decent meal. That feels like a quote Ernest Cline squirreled away for this book at some point, but putting it immediately opposite the page where the main character forsakes the real world and promises to never leave his room just demonstrates a complete lack of self-awareness. Editor Gherkin here. I went to find a clip of Groucho Marx to insert here, but it turns out he never actually said that. Oh, how it pleases me to be able to correct Mr. Know Every Pop Culture Reference. Mwah! Chef kiss. But a complete lack of self-awareness for this book is nothing new, so I'm sure we'll find more of it next episode. If you want more from someone with no self-awareness, you can follow me on Twitter at TheLastGherkin or follow the show on Twitter at RPN_pod. Watch the episodes with subtitles on YouTube, TheLastGherkin, or get an MP3 download at thelastgherkin.podbean.com for as long as I continue to consider that a good investment of my money. In the comments below, inspired by the Wasteland Scavengers, let me know what you think is the most exciting thing happening off-screen in this story. I'm gonna go look for bombs on eBay. I hope I don't get caught! Excuse me. Just name an evil megacorporizer. Just name a real-life megacorporizer. And for every major corporization, I keep saying corporization. What was that noise?